fools. Do you enjoy the podcast? Become a patron. It feels great. This podcast is brought to you by everybody that has signed up through Patreon and helps donate a monthly recurring sum to support the podcast. I'm going to shout out my patrons. Then I'm going to give you the two rules for the podcast. Then we're going to get on our way today. First and foremost, I want to shout out my friends over at The Trader's Path. The Trader's Path is a brand new service for day traders that just started last year. It's being run by my buddy Pete, and he created it because he got tired of other day trading services taking advantage of him. What does Pete do over at The Trader's Path? They trade red markets, they trade green markets, they trade equities, they trade options. You're going to get daily watch lists. You're going to get live streams of everything they're doing. So you're going to be getting ideas and information and investor education all throughout the day. It's a great tool to have if you are a day trader. Right now, they are adding a swing trading only service. If you're a busy professional and you're just trading on the side, it's priced accordingly. It includes all the educational videos, charting, daily swing trade watch lists, all their alerts. Members are going to get 3 to 5 alerts each week on small caps, large caps, and options trades. And it's $100 off right now if you buy it using the QTR podcast. Check out the link in my podcast description and say what's up to my homeboy, Pete. Also, if you're a day trader, you might be interested in the Sang Lucci Steam Room. This podcast is brought to you by my friends over at Sang Lucci. What does Sang Lucci and his brother Charlie Bathgate do? They have the Steam Room, which is a daily chat room that goes on all day, and all they do is track big money coming into the options market. If you've been trading for a little while, or maybe you don't know, tracking the money in the illiquid options market is a great way to figure out where equities could be heading in the future. It is a skill that Sang Lucci and Charlie have honed over the course of the last decade. These guys are fantastic traders. They're wonderful human beings. And if you're not interested in the Steam Room, you can check out Sang Lucci's Investing Master Course or the 3LT Playbook. All the links to all of these are in the podcast description. And the 3LT Playbook is very simple. If you don't have time, 3 rules that Lucci uses to become the trader that he is today. My fine feathered friend Sang Lucci, I love those guys. Please check them out in the podcast description and check out my podcasts with my homeboy, Sang Lucci. This podcast is also brought to you by my dear friends over at Rumorhound. If you want to add another tool to your day trading arsenal, check out Rumorhound.ai. What does it do? Rumorhound is a tool that looks at and identifies all the merger and acquisition rumors that take place on a daily basis. So if you're a day trader, you know they happen all the time. Rumorhound sorts through them, takes the rumor, looks at a proprietary group of variables that it plugs into its proprietary artificial intelligence-based algorithm to, I know a lot of fancy words, a lot of hot shit there, takes all that information and spits back out to you a recommendation on whether or not the rumor is something you may want to pay attention to or something you may want to leave alone. Of course, everybody knows that getting out ahead of M&A rumors when they work can be very lucrative business. So if you're looking for a way to kind of help add something to your decision-making toolbox, check out my friends over at rumorhound.ai. They have been longtime supporters of the podcast and very dear friends, and I appreciate them. It's a beautiful piece of software. I've seen it myself, and you can follow them also on Twitter at rumorhound. This podcast also brought to you by my friends at Corvus Gold, my friend Monero, shipping analyst Jay Mintzmyer, my homeboy, Russ Valenti, my dear friend, Nicholas Parks, my buddy Nathan Michaud over at Investors Underground and Traders for a Cause. Thank you for your continued support, Nathan. And some of my older patrons, guys like Chris Bede and Ken R., Chris Boas, you guys have been supporting me for a long-ass time, and I appreciate that shit. Crichton Titus, thank you, my friend. And Ken, I see you still in the house. J.K. Cunningham and Stank Love, Brainerd Ferguson, all you guys. Thank you guys so much. Some of my older patrons, guys that I haven't shouted out in a while, guys like Wallaby390 and Andrew White, I still see you. Bottles and Models Capital, thank you for continuing to be a patron. Brad Hamlin, John Weber, Jeff Blanning, thank you guys so much. Craig Schwartz and Carson Rasmussen, I appreciate you guys. If you want to be a patron, check out the Patreon link. I've plastered it everywhere fucking imaginable. So you can find it, but just only when you open your eyes. If not, I appreciate your support anyways. 2 rules for today's podcast. First and foremost, this podcast requires a 2-drink minimum. How does that work? Folks, we're using integers here. You start at zero. If you've had zero drinks today, you put the first one down, that puts you at one. You put the second one down, that puts you at two. Then you turn around and hit play on the podcast. I'll give you 3 seconds to pause it now so you can take two to the face before we get started. Ready? Good. Other people have moments of silence for, you know, when somebody of prestige dies or some type of event or, you know, whatever. I have moments of silence so that people can get properly lubricated for the podcast, ladies and gentlemen. Final rule, I'm not an investment advisor. Don't take my advice, because if you do, you will wind up broke and living in a dumpster. That is the only guarantee I can give you, folks. I hold no licenses, no registrations. Do your research elsewhere. Don't want to hear about your successes. Don't want to hear about your failures. Not fucking interested. Do it elsewhere, folks. Your research, that is. All right. I have with me on the line today, man of the month, man of 2020 so far, Wall Street's man of 2020, Mr. Mark Spiegel of Stanfill Capital. Hello, Mark. Are you alive? Are you breathing? How are you?
I'll settle for the man of 4:28 p.m. on January 23rd, which is when we're doing this, for about 10 seconds. That I'll settle for that man. 10 seconds of the month. How about that?
Oh, you're a 10-second guy, huh?
I wish I was a 10-second guy.
Oh, it's funny, Mark. I never get so many requests to have you on as I have over the last 3 weeks since you've been getting your dick punched in on Tesla. All of a sudden, everybody's interested in hearing from you. You know,
and you know what? People getting their dicks punched in love to hear about other people getting their dicks punched in.
That's actually quite true. I think there's some Schadenfreude out there.
And Dickery loves company. By the way, I love the way you mispronounced that German word.
Which one? Schadenfreude? Schadenfreude?
Yeah. I don't know how to pronounce it either, but I just know whatever you said.
Well, how do you know it's wrong? How do you know it's wrong?
Because I've heard it pronounced correctly, and it didn't sound anything like whatever just came out of South Philly or wherever you are.
But you can't remember it.
Correct. I just remember it was wrong. It's like when you hear something that's off pitch, even though you may not have perfect pitch, you can still tell.
This is like that time that Trump said he witnessed people celebrating 9/11, and then they asked him who it was that he saw. And he said, I can't remember who it was, but I definitely remember that I saw it because I have, quote, the world's greatest memory.
Yeah, so me witnessing you mispronouncing Schadenfreude, or however you're supposed to say it, is sort of just like Trump witnessing people from 9/11.
Well, my German is mostly pre-industrial, okay? You wouldn't understand the dialects that I'm bringing to the table. You know, you're speaking modern German, Mark. I'm a bit refined.
That was during a previous era of global warming when they didn't have some little pain in the ass 17-year-old school dropout running around lecturing us. You know, Zero Hedge is right. Send that little, you know what, to China. Let her fucking lecture them, or India or Africa. You know, she's lecturing.
I'm not sure she would go over well in China.
Yeah. She's lecturing the people who are already getting taxed to the gills to subsidize all this crap on which no politician actually does a cost value analysis. I mean, and I've talked about that on ours. You know,
she's a bit much, huh?
Yeah. Anyway, you know what? Fuck it. She'll meet some guy and get knocked up, and that's the last we'll hear about her.
I don't know about that. Where do you come up with this shit?
Just from my old sexist upbringing.
All right. Well, that actually sounds like a reasonable answer to that question.
Yeah, I grew up when men were men. You know, not that I was one necessarily, but I was surrounded by them. So I picked a lot of that stuff up.
Doesn't exist anymore. Men can be whatever they want. Women can be whatever they want. Hey, look, I'm a libertarian. I'm okay with whatever anybody. But let's just not like, you know, let's not get insane here. All right, with it. This whole going back to her real quick. That first lecture she did. When was that? Was that at Davos last year? When she did that first?
Well, I don't know. There was the I Dare You. That was at the UN.
The UN
in last fall, I think. Right.
It was a bit much. I don't know. I feel like now they're wheeling her out kind of as theater now.
Listen, I mean, the whole thing is nuts. I mean, they're trying to make something into a crisis when temperatures are going up, you know, 0.15 degrees per decade, and it's unclear how much of that is caused by man, you know?
Right.
I mean, the car subsidy, I mean, forget Tesla because they didn't get the new subsidy, but these politicians are trying to do it. You know, $7,000 a car is what they wanted to extend this, right? Just like one paragraph of simple math here, okay? There are what was that noise?
That was me back in my chair.
Oh my God.
That was me ripping ass.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah, I thought so.
In some countries that's considered a compliment when you're speaking to somebody. That's a compliment to the chef in some restaurants in Morocco and other places.
Yeah, yeah. That strikes me as kind of like one of those internet myths. I'll have to go on Snopes. Look that one up. Why don't you go to Morocco and try that and let me know what it's like in a Moroccan prison.
Okay.
Son, have you ever been in a Moroccan prison? So where was I? This car's. So there are a billion cars in the world, approximately, literally, right? All these cars combined contribute 11% of man-made CO2, okay? So, you know, people will say, oh, well, transportation, that's 20-something percent of man-made. No, that includes planes, trains, boats, you know, railroad, or right. That's trains. That includes trucks is the big contributor. No, cars are 11% of man-made CO2. There are a billion in the world. You tell me, Mr. Politician or Ms. Politician, the fucking cost-value analysis of spending $7,000 to electrify one-billionth of the cars on Earth, right, when all of them together are 11% of man-made CO2. Not one of them has done that math. It's just a feel-good, grotesque waste of taxpayer money, you know? I mean, there are cost-effective things that can be done if you care about CO2. That is not one of them. And it just burns my ass, speaking of breaking wind, it burns my ass that politicians are willing to squander, you know, billions and billions of dollars of taxpayer money without even doing a basic back-of-the-envelope justification for it, you know?
I think a big problem with the climate debate is that people who are climate activists who raise – you know, factual points, right? Like there's more parts per million of CO2 in the atmosphere now than there's ever been, or than there has been in recent history. Definitely facts, definitely things that we need to pay attention to, definitely things that need to be considered. But I think the problem with the debate is if you're a capitalist, right? Like you are, like I am, and you realize that, as Fleckenstein would say, you know, business and capitalism has to be the engine with which we affect change, whether it's, you know, we're going to change things for climate change, or we're going to change things elsewhere, we're going to change social services, whatever. If you believe that capitalism is the system that's going to catalyze that change for something as enormous as dealing with climate change, obviously it would have to be. You know, if you're an activist, many of them are advocating for this point that, oh, it should just be all hands on deck and all the work that should be done for it should all be done for free, or the government should pay for it, or everybody, you know, we should just be living in this communistic utopia where everybody just agrees that it's the right thing for the common good and that it gets dealt with. Just putting aside the alarmism for a second, you know, which is, A, we're all going to die.
We have
15 days left. So the point I'm trying to make, though, is that I think there's a middle ground there, right? Like, I think that the climate is changing. I think that it is important to have it's important to have context with how it's changing over how it's changed historically. And I think the point that you make that is important is we have to be reasonable and we have to use common sense as to how we're going to affect change. Because if we can't be practical in affecting change, then there's going to be nothing's going to get done. And the activists and the alarmists, they don't want that. They want to just scream and lecture and virtue signal. And go ahead.
No, I was going to say, let's take a step back, because, look, it's not going to come. Well, OK, it's not going to come from capitalism without some impetus or requirement from government, because the natural way of capitalism is to externalize costs while internalizing profits, right? So if some guy just doesn't give a shit about the environment, and he's running a chemical factory, and he can save, you know, $1 billion, you know, a year by just dumping chemicals into the river rather than treating them, he's going to do it, right? So you do need laws. I'm not crazy. I understand you need this stuff. But everything we do in this regard should have a cost-benefit analysis. It's like, okay, you want to spend, you know, $100 billion subsidizing a year, subsidizing electric cars? I mean, what's his name? Bloomberg's talking about making every car electric by 2035, or maybe he means just every new car sale or whatever. It doesn't matter. The point is, okay, how much temperature reduction can I expect to get for every dollar of taxes I'm spending? And if I don't spend it, and we instead were 1/1 trillionth of a degree warmer for each car we don't, you know, electrify, whatever the hell we're talking about. So what are the ramifications of that? Are we better off just not having new development on the coast? I mean, all of this stuff, it's not like we're all going to fucking die if the Earth's temperature goes up, you know, 1.5 degrees over the next 50 years or whatever it's doing, or 2 degrees. It's going to be warmer. Maybe the oceans rise somewhat, you know, but it doesn't mean you have to spend $100 trillion, you know. Maybe we just, quote unquote, deal with it, right? Or to take another step back, you know, going back to your capitalism idea, tax carbon if this is your thing, and then let capitalism figure out the best way to do it, you know? And like, okay, do we pull it out of the air? Does it become cost effective that way? You know, do we go to hybrid cars instead of pure electrics? I mean, don't have the government mandate all this crap, because I have yet to hear one fucking politician give me a financial analysis of why his program, you know, makes sense. It's all feel good nonsense. And of course, this all even assumes that we can control the weather, right? It all assumes that all of this temperature increase is due to man, which it's likely not. But OK, fine. You want to take precautions. But, you know, let's just like take a step back. And what if we don't spend $1 trillion and instead we spend, you know, $100 billion moving people off the coast? I mean, these are real questions that should be asked. I mean, Dave Collum, your frequent guest, did a fantastic job dealing with this, far more eloquently than I do, in his that long annual letter he put out. I mean, I urge people to find that. It was extremely intelligent. He's not a quote unquote denier, which really fucking pisses me off when I see that in the Times. It's like, oh, you know, it's like denying the Holocaust, you know, someone questioning the cost benefit analysis of all this, of all the climate stuff that people are trying to do. So at any rate, enough of that, but people should read Collum's thing and they'll get a good idea.
I think activists don't understand that you can question the cost benefit analysis without denying that there's more, you know, parts per million of CO2 in the atmosphere than there were 50 years ago, right? I mean, that's a fact.
Right. Right.
So it's, well, how does that fit into the context of what we're talking about, and what about that is a practical solution, that, you know, is a proposal for a practical solution? I mean,
right. I mean, there's three questions. Number one, how much of that comes from man? Is more than three questions. Number two, how much of that is causing the rise in temperatures?
Right.
And number three. You know, what is the real effect of that rise in temperatures, and how can we best deploy money to deal with it? And maybe deploying money to deal with it isn't even to electrify cars or whatever. Maybe deploying money to deal with it is move people in from the coast or build a seawall around Miami or whatever. I don't know. I mean, meanwhile, obviously, none of these crazy predictions have come true, but we don't know for sure that they won't. But again, let's see some back of the envelope math. You know, at least liberal politicians, they're like allergic to math. You know, I'm no freaking math genius. You know, I mean, I got a C- in AP calculus, okay? But I can take out an envelope and subtract and multiply and divide and say, okay, what am I getting for this money? And that's what every politician should be required to do. You know, they do these polls, right? And now, like, oh yeah, people are more concerned about global warming because they're hit with so much propaganda. And then you ask them how much they're willing to spend to reduce global warming. And I think I just saw a poll, like, the average American is willing to spend an extra $1 a month, you know, but not an extra $10 a month, much less, you know, an extra hundreds of dollars a month, which these politicians are thousands. Anyway. So look, I don't want to be on a soapbox.
And we're
so
also obvious. We're ignoring the fact that we're the furthest along that we've come in terms of trying to do, you know, what's economically sustainable and trying to do what's green. So, you know, we're the furthest along in that move. We're the amount of carbon that we're emitting is, I think, at, you know, lows, decade lows, two decade lows, three decade lows, or whatever. I mean, you know, since the 50s or the 60s, since we had all that industry and production. So we've addressed the problem. We're moving in the right direction. You know, even Andrew Yang said at one of the debates, he's like, you know, have you said something like the ocean will rise and people will move in from Miami, you know, and like.
Yeah, but I've yet to hear Yang. I mean, Yang is a big fan of, oh, we should make every car electric. So I reached out to him a couple times on Twitter. Obviously, you know, he's probably got thousands of people. I even reached out to, I met somebody who's one of his top advisors. And I said, ask Andrew this question. I said, you know, here's a simple paragraph. 1 billion cars in the world, totaling 11% of man-made CO2. How much does he expect to get for spending $1 trillion of taxpayer money electrifying cars? No answer. None of these people have a fucking answer, you know? Don't spend my money without telling me what I'm getting for it. It's that simple, you know? Every politician who wants to spend any money on anything should be telling the voters exactly what they're getting for that money, you know? And none of them will tell you on this global warming shit, you know? So,
And it's being used as a shoehorn to further policy initiatives, too, which is even worse.
Well, that's what they say, right? They say this is a way of the AOCs of the world to socialize the whole country, redistribute the money. I don't know. They're not going to redistribute the money. Scumbags like Musk will pocket tens of billions of dollars with this bullshit. That's how the money will get redistributed. You know, Mnuchin, who strikes me as just a real total weasel, right? Yeah.
I can't imagine why he would come off like that.
Yeah, exactly.
He looks like an honest guy.
Said completely the right thing. Well, almost completely the right thing. You know, this morning when he slapped down that little, I won't use the word. When he slapped When he slapped
She's
down Greta. When he slapped down Greta. And said, you know, let her go to college and study economics. Now, my first thought was, no. You study economics in college today, all you get is fucking Marxism. That's probably not the best thing. Let her go to college. I don't know where they treat regular, real economics. I don't know, University of Chicago or something. You know, let her not learn crazy economics.
Vienna.
But, you know, really, Greta just needs to find Hansel and settle down somewhere in a fucking, you know, gingerbread house and leave us the fuck alone.
Or Gretel, you know, whatever you're into is fine with me. I'm a libertarian, but she's a minor, so we'll take it easy on her until she's of legal age, and then you can unload on her a little bit more. But we'll spare her the rest. You know, this always the debate about climate change always reminds me of that George Carlin skit when he's like, you know, people are walking around saying save the planet. He's like, the planet is going to be fine. The people are the ones that are fucked, you know? It's like everybody's saying, oh, it's about Earth, you know? There's only one Earth. You know, the Earth has been here for billions of years. It has endured far worse than a couple of cities popping up and a couple of, you know, Ford Mustangs and Super Duties driving around, rolling coal, as my hick friends out in West New York would say.
So, yeah. By the way, meanwhile, I mean, just to be clear, I'm as much of a social libertarian as you are. And so, I mean, I make a lot of jokes on Twitter just because, you know, to be honest, I just like going for cheap laughs. But really, I don't care. I don't care what anybody does. I'm all for everybody's rights. Look, I don't want to pay for more than two bathrooms, you know, or maybe like as for my taxes in public buildings. Maybe I'll pay for three bathrooms, like a men's, a women's, and a what the fuck is that? Okay, so we'll have three bathrooms and not more. And you can use whichever one you want. I don't care. But don't make me have 14 genders and have to pay for all those bathrooms. Go ahead. Sorry.
I agree with you. I think that that's fine. You know, the whole like, oh, there's 36 genders things. It's like, oh, no, come on. 36? Why not 35? You know, what about 37? How come 37 couldn't edge in there? What I will say is I think a great use of taxpayer money is those family restrooms that they put into like malls and things like that, because usually they're a lot cleaner, they're a lot bigger, they're a lot nicer. So if you're like walking around the mall and you got to use the bathroom, I remember when I used to work for Apple in King of Prussia, and they had like a regular men's room and a regular women's room, and then they had the family bathroom, you know, with the whole picture of the whole family on the door, and anybody can use, and it was great. It was like 400 square feet. There was a couch. Like, everything was always clean. It smelled good. You can just go in there, post up for a nice, you know, 45 minutes, fuck around on your phone while you're supposed to be at work. So I'm an advocate for the family restrooms.
Right. By the way, that's obviously not government. That's the mall, which, by the way, malls are apparently just empty these days. I mean, it's just by the way, I have on the corner of my screen here, CNBC, and for some reason they have Priyanka Chopra on, you know, that Indian actress,
yeah,
Jonas' wife. She is beautiful. She, yeah. I mean, she's not exactly on the thin side, to be honest with you, but, you know, from like the neck up, she's spectacular. Anyway, so so malls are empty.
Mark Spiegel, on the other hand, named two Times 100 sexiest men on the front cover, right?
From the neck up. Well, I'd have different categories: neck up, neck down. Maybe you can mix and match the pieces. Anyway, so mall bathrooms probably very clean these days because nobody uses them, you know. And airport bathrooms are generally disgusting. Although it's so pleasant, I was, you know, visiting my dad last week in Arizona, and Phoenix Airport is so nice and beautiful and clean. And then you come back to JFK, which is just disgusting,
dude,
you know?
This woman is so sexy. I can't believe
it. Oh, you got it on now, right?
Well, you know, yeah. There is nothing wrong with this woman at all. Zero.
Even like the whole thing?
Zero. This woman is a perfect woman. That is a
all right. You know, she always struck me as sort of on the verge of, you know, maybe being, you know, slightly oversized. And Jonas
is full of shit.
If
you fucking were at a bar and this woman walked up to you and just said hello, you would fucking fall over.
I would right there. Yep. Yep.
You wouldn't be like, excuse me, your face is beautiful, but I was worried about, you seem a little oversized. Could I mix and match some parts? Maybe I could take your left hand with your right foot and, you know, come on, Spiegel. Let's be serious here.
Yeah, no, I mean, let's face it. Who's the blonde chick who's interviewing her in CNBC?
I don't know.
She makes you look like a total dog. And normally, like, she's, like, not bad looking, that blonde chick, right? So, that's a true test. That's how you know if a woman is really beautiful. If she's being interviewed by a TV anchor who you're like, oh, she's a pretty hot TV anchor. And then the interviewee makes her look just like a dog. Then you know she's
What happened to good old-fashioned getting to know somebody, you know? I mean, come on, Mark. What is going on in your life, in your head, on a daily basis?
I pretty much only watch CNBC with the sound off as a fluke. I happened to hear a little bit of Fast Money the other day, so I don't get to know any of these people. I just completely judge them superficially.
Yeah, well, you know what? Everybody's got their own style. You know what I mean? Yeah. I guess that's your style. Hey, let's talk about Tesla because it's up like fucking 250 points since the last time that we talked. One of the things that I said the last time that we spoke was, Mark, it's insane and it's a bubble. And the market is, if it's going to ascribe a $75 billion market cap to it or $150 billion market cap to it, there's essentially no difference because they're both insane. We're just talking about different degrees of insanity. But what has happened here since this last earnings report is the stock has just gone absolutely apeshit. It has destroyed fucking short sellers. It has now a $100 billion valuation. And as I tweeted yesterday, I think is getting dangerously close to some type of escape velocity. Which what I mean by that is if the valuation of the company gets up high enough, they can go out and raise money at this ridiculous valuation and buy themselves an infinite amount of time, essentially. What do you make
of
that?
All right, so a few things. There's a lot to unpack there. So, you know, escape velocity. Look, the stock already is in escape velocity. Let's take a step back. First of all, Tesla, you know, wrecked my year again last year. I mean, we were up, I don't know, mid-single digits going into December, despite having a large diversified short book in a very up year for the market. We were still up. We were very net short, and we wound up the year down, I think it was like 6.5%, and that was all Tesla, which just wrecked us in December. But here's the deal. There was a time when, Tesla's always been a bubble and a crazy valuation, but it used to react, you know, to bad news, right? And then it was in December when it had this huge run-up and the market was expecting an extension of that $7,000 tax credit. I mean, everyone was talking about it. It was going to be a slam dunk. And it didn't happen. I remember the news broke one afternoon. The stock was like, call it 379 or 380. The news breaks that it's not in the deal. It's not happening. Apparently, Trump or Trump's guy, Mulvaney, single-handedly supposedly killed that and just said, we're not signing this if that's in there. And by the way, that's what makes me think that, you know, people all speculating yesterday, you know, Trump is protecting Musk. Trump or Trump's right-hand guy single-handedly killed that electric car credit. So I've also heard it said that Trump was being pretty sarcastic about Musk yesterday and people just didn't pick it up. So I don't know where we're at. But anyway, stocks at, call it 379, 380. The tax credit doesn't go through. The stock maybe dips, I don't know, $2 or $3, something like that, after this huge run-up that was supposedly expecting it, and then closes, you know, I don't know, plus or minus a few bucks on change. The next day, it's up another 10 bucks or something, sets another new all-time high. That's when I said, okay, this is now decoupled from reality where seriously bad news is not affecting it at all. So I took our position down substantially. This was sometime like late December, you know, in, I don't know, call it the 380s. And since then, our equity position has been down substantially. What killed us this month, at least the first 3 weeks of this month, well, it really was the first week because I'm not holding it anymore. We had a few percent of the fund in January 2021, 690 calls that I had sold, okay? I sold them in the 17s. In 2018, when the stock was in the 300s, right? And these things are struck at 690. I thought it was absurd. I rode them all the way down to like 50 cents and I never bought them back. I said, you know what? Why should I take this? Why should I take this big tax gain, you know, in 2019 when I can postpone it till 2021? I'll be doing all my LPs a big favor. Why take this tax? Of course, they rocketed back up. You know, they opened this month, I don't know, like in the low teens. And all of a sudden, they're moving like crazy as the stock moves. And I wound up buying them all back at like $25 to $35 after round tripping them to 50 cents. At one point yesterday, thank God I was long out of them, they were up to like $70, right? I mean, they were selling, I didn't look today, but you know, calls expiring a year from now, January 2021, with a strike of $1,015, 1015, were like $16, $17, something like that. It was insane. So anyway, that really killed us. So, you know, this month it killed us. I mean, we're down again, like, I don't know, probably mid-single digit percentages this month, you know, maybe 6%, something like that. But that's all gone. And all we have now is an equity short position in Tesla, which I varied, you know, depending, you know, 5%, 10%, sometimes a little more. But here's what I've been doing, okay? At some point, there is going to be a blow off top here. And, you know, I thought it was earlier this month and it wasn't. So what I've kind of been doing is, you know, stock sets this blow off high and then retrenches a little. I've upsized the position a few bucks below that high and then just set a stop at the high. And if it takes out the high, boom, I'm out of it. So, you know, maybe I'm risking $3 a share, $5 a share, $7 a share, whatever it is. It's a very low percentage amount on a $570 stock. And, you know, so far it hasn't worked, although we have made some money kind of, you know, we've cut our losses a little bit trading that. Yesterday had all the hallmarks, you know, of the blow off top, right? Over 30 million shares of volume, you know, massive short covering, massive spike, and yet a pretty big sell off at the end and a big red candle, you know, on a daily candlestick chart. But so yesterday, again, I upsized us at 590, okay, with a stop at the high of 594.50 or whatever it is. So, you know, I'm risking a very little bit of money on, you know, checking every box as yesterday being the blow-off top. And in fact, I'll even lower that stop. I mean, if I'm right and yesterday was the blow-off top, then even today's high shouldn't be taken out again. Today's high was 582. So, you know, I'm just doing this in a low risk situation. This stock trades from 4 a.m. to 8 p.m. So if some news breaks at 4 in the morning or 7:30 at night, I'm covered there also. So that's how I'm playing this, because as I said on Twitter, this thing, you know, unless maybe it's now finished, but it was just trading. It was like Bitcoin. In other words, like, it wasn't grounded to anything except emotion and momentum, and no news, no fundamental analysis, none of that made any difference. You know, is it now going to make a difference? I don't know. Maybe we'll find out. I'm taking another shot here, and if I'm wrong, you know, it'll cost me a few extra bucks, not a lot.
Did you see they so a couple of things. I mean, first, let's talk first and foremost. What do you say to people that say that it has kind of reached that escape velocity at this valuation of $105 billion?
Yeah, yeah,
it can
yeah,
go out
okay,
it
yeah,
can
let
make
me answer
it can
that. Sorry.
It can acquire profitable companies now if it wants to, using its stock as currency. It can issue stock and probably raise $10 billion if it wants to at a ridiculous valuation, which is ostensibly the perfect time to do it. You know, the Shanghai factory's up. The factory in Germany is on its way, supposedly. Yes, they have a lot of back orders for shit they haven't produced yet. But, I mean, what do you say
to
that?
All right, let me answer that. First, they don't have, quote-unquote, a lot of back orders on shit they haven't produced yet, okay? Number two, the Shanghai factory, we've been through this before, I think, on multiple previous podcasts. It's been in my letter. You know, they were selling, like, 30,000 Model 3s a year there, and the new pricing is going to be about a third less. And if you look at typically the elasticity of autos, it means they'll sell 60,000 a year or something like that, right? The factory initial capacity is 150, you know? Same thing in Europe, you know, it's way more. Musk is building these factories because this entire thing is a giant stock promotion, okay? And to keep the stock promotion going, he's got to keep the idea that, oh yeah, we have this infinite demand and we'll build these factories all over the world. Well, you know what? You can always create demand if you cut prices enough, okay? They do not have infinite demand at price points that will make these cars profitable. They absolutely don't. The company is not profitable now. There's been a lot of work done on their bullshit, you know, warranty reserve and a bunch of one-time stuff, and they wouldn't have been profitable last quarter, you know, Q3. I don't know what they're going to show for Q4, whatever it is. If there's a profit there, it's got an equal amount of bullshit in it. So it's not a viable business. Now, to your point, I have not claimed for a while, I'm going to say, you know, a year, something like that, that this company was in any danger of going bankrupt. And the reason for that is, you know, anytime you've got a stock that was, you know, 250, 350, 450, 550 a share trading, you know, now it's trading, you know, like $10 or $15 billion a day. Even last year, it was trading $5 or $6 billion a day or whatever. There's no danger of bankruptcy as long as you're willing to sell discounted stock. You know, half the hedge funds in America that might think the company is a joke and a fraud would buy into that deal if it's an overnight deal priced at a 5% or a 7% discount. And they would just, you know, if you could raise, Musk could raise $2 billion right now at a 5% discount, and every fund that bought it would just blow it all out, you know, by 11 a.m. tomorrow. And, you know, maybe they'd make 2.5%, you know, they'd capture half of that spread. And annualized, that's an enormous amount of money. I mean, he could probably get a Ken Griffin on the phone and raise $2 billion at the snap of a finger, you know, down 5% at a 5% discount. So they're not going ever. But that said, you know, what you can have is you can have a company where it's got plenty of cash, but it's people realize it's a joke of a business, and it just, you know, sells at the cash value minus the debt, which is very little. And in fact, after the internet bubble broke, there were plenty of companies that were not viable businesses that sold below cash, and because the cash was gradually getting burned. And that could absolutely, you know, happen with Tesla. As far as buying a profitable business, look, it's hard to know what would happen there, okay? When Time Warner and AOL merged, you know, AOL used its incredibly expensive stock to buy what at that point were a lot of real assets, which was Time Warner, you know, back when magazines were worth something, and of course HBO, everything they got, whatever they got, you know, the whole thing collapsed because AOL had this new world PE multiple, whatever it was. It might have been triple digits or whatever. And as I recall, the earnings on AOL were phony anyway, because they were like, you know, depreciating the customers much more slowly than the customers were leaving or something. But that's a whole other story. Anyway, so they bought a hard asset. They bought Time Warner. And then the whole thing collapsed because all of a sudden people owned, oh, we own this old world Time Warner media company, right? It wasn't sexy anymore. What would happen? Listen, Musk should have bought FCAU or whatever, right? But then that would have killed the whole story here and the whole sexiness and whatever. Now, you know what? You know, he's got such a rabid fan base. Maybe they think Musk could buy – it's too late now because they have a deal already. Maybe they think Musk could have bought an FCAU or whatever. And then, like, he would have turned it into some amazing company, and maybe he'd get some leeway. I don't know. But here's the thing. Here's why I think Musk is not, you know, doing a quick deal, selling equity to, you know, to raise cash, or for that matter, issuing equity to buy something else. Musk knows that the relatively restricted float of this company is what keeps the stock price, or one of the things that keeps the stock price so crazy elevated. And he, to him, it's like anathema to issue a bunch more shares that would pop his bubble. That's why I'd say it's more likely than anything that he does another convert deal, you know, when he goes to raise money, you know. But I don't know what he'll do. Listen, it's not going to kill the stock if he raised $2 billion at 500, you know, 4 million shares. I don't think it's going to kill it, but I think he would hesitate even to do that. So those are my thoughts on that. They're definitely not going bankrupt. That doesn't mean the company would be worth, you know, as an ongoing business, anything more than its net cash, you know, and something for the land it owns or the machines or whatever.
Yeah, interesting. I mean, you just look at all of the possibilities that he has, though, now with the stock price the way that it is. And I mean, I think he has to raise money here. I think it would be, you know, my question is, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. Right. So if he goes out and he raises $10 billion here, right, which, you know, I think he could probably do. It offers it at a 10% discount, which is essentially some type of convertible preferred. Hear me out. Some type of discount makes it sexy enough to go out. Let's say he raises $7.5 billion or $5 billion. Then fine. Right. You're right. The institutions will short it against the box. They'll be out of it. It'll be a very quick return for them. Annualized, it'd be fantastic, et cetera,
et cetera.
Let me finish my thought. My thought is that the idea of having cash here still kind of works to further the long kind of narrative, which is the company is financially stable, and that the real earnings, the real shift in the company's business model and the earnings and the software as a service and all that fucking horse shit, the mobility, et cetera, 10, 15, 20 years out now, but what does it matter, right?
What you're saying is completely true. You know, the stock might even go up a little bit on a raise, but it won't stay up, I don't think, with another, you know, 5 or 6 or 7 million or 8 million shares out there that get dumped into the market, you know? I could be wrong, but that's my thought. But that's also why Musk would most likely not do a big equity deal here, and instead, you know, would probably do another convert deal, you know, that raise $2 billion on a convert, which he could also do it in a finger snap, you know? I don't think he could raise, by the way, you know, you said $10 billion or $7.5 billion, you know, in an equity deal, because that's a lot of stock to dump at once. I mean, he could do it, but he'd have to price it at a, you know, a much bigger discount, you know, maybe a 15% discount or something. And I think he'd be loath to do that, although he should. But it doesn't matter.
Even now, a 15% discount would put the deal at $500.
Yeah, correct. No, I hear you. Right. So, but no sane person who knows anything about capital markets thinks this company is going bankrupt anytime soon. Because you're right. They have a very liquid currency out there. But at the end of the day, I still think it's going to be worth less than its debt, which is, you know, $11 or $12 billion. You know, maybe in the best possible case, it's worth, you know, $20 billion as an enterprise value. So it's worth, you know, $8 billion of equity. So $40 a share, whatever, you know. So, you know, look, it's got to converge there eventually, you know. And look, I think it happens later this year when Europe starts rolling out, you know, scores of different electric cars. Here's the crazy thing. This company, which is priced for hypergrowth and total bubble valuation, they had a negative revenue comp in Q3 year over year, okay? Q4, the one they're going to report next week was most likely flat at best year over year, maybe $100 million down on revenue even, right? I mean, what kind of growth company is no longer growing revenue? The whole thing is absurd, you know? These people are like, oh, they'll go to China, they'll grow all the revenue. Listen, you'll get a little bit of net extra car sales in China, you know? Maybe, as I said, maybe 40, 50,000 a year more than you have, but you're gonna run that factory at a loss, you know? In Europe, you probably won't get anything extra. I mean, Netherlands totally juiced Q4, that's gone, you know? There's, England has some incentives, but there's a lot of competition. Anyway, the point is there are no facts that seem to matter for this company right now, or at least maybe they start mattering now after yesterday. Maybe I say it's a blow off top. And it is what it is. So, you know, you try to time your entry right, you try not to get hurt, and at some point it recouples with reality. You know, another thing which was talked about a lot, which is another reason besides the chart yesterday that makes me think that could have been it, I don't know, is the fact that, you know, people are starting to go, oh, you know, they have a higher market cap than Volkswagen, right? I mean, Volkswagen by unit sales is the largest car manufacturer in the world. They sell, I don't know, 10.6 million cars a year. Tesla's going to sell low 400,000s of cars this year, right? And Volkswagen is incredibly profitable, and they own Porsche and Audi and other high-end brands, Lamborghini, whatever. And, you know, so the whole thing is, that's another reason of absurdity. I mean, when everybody is there saying, this is crazy, it's absurd, I mean, listen, you have to think maybe somebody at Baillie Gifford says, well, wait a second, $100 billion bigger than Volkswagen, maybe we should sell some stock. They probably didn't, you know, but that's what somebody should be saying there, you know?
What happens if Volkswagen, you know, joins with Tesla in some type of strategic partnership or takes 10% of the company?
Absolutely no reason whatsoever to do that. Volkswagen has its own platform, multiple cars coming out, you know, there's been a lot of good articles. You know, the thing that bulls on this company say, well, Teslas have more range. You can find several articles, a terrific one in the Washington Post maybe 2 weeks ago or a week and a half ago, explaining that the reason Teslas have more range is they stress their batteries much more highly and use much more of their battery. And what they're doing is, it's the way Musk runs everything by the seat of his pants. They're not worried about 6-7 years down the road, that battery warranty, 8 years down the road. They're going for all the flash they can show you today, right, and not worry about the future. It's the same way Musk puts this killer, reckless, you know, autopilot on the road, right? He's like, oh, if we get all the lawsuits, we'll deal with them later, right? You know, the guy who's the CEO of Daimler or BMW, he says, I am the steward of this 100-something-year-old company, and I'm not going to run this, you know, like, I don't give a fuck what happens to it in 5 years. Which, by the way, is exactly what that jerk-off who was running Boeing did, right? The guy who ran Boeing was a Musk-style CEO. He basically, you know, took as much as he could out of the company. Musk does it in different ways with his pay package and then hyping the stock to get his options. And he's like, oh, yeah, well, you know, we'll hodgepodge fix the 737 MAX. This guy, in his term as CEO, single-handedly destroyed the reputation of Boeing of being like the company of engineering excellence representing the whole USA, you know? You talk to a pilot a few years ago, like, would you rather fly a Boeing or an Airbus? Oh, Boeing, everything is triple redundant and this and that. And he fucking destroyed it out of his dumbass greed, you know?
Wow, they had a huge race going on with Airbus, right? And they needed to get the 737 MAX finished to compete. And so they sacrificed all of the, you know, a lot of the checks and balances and, you know, all of the safety and those types of things because they wanted to get something done so they could turn around and fucking sell it. Yeah, I mean,
that's part of it. But the other part of it, and look, you might have studied this more than I, but he never should have done that plane in the first place.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
He should have designed a whole new plane, but he figured, oh, we'll save money. Yeah, and we'll put different engines on this thing and turn it into a fucking unflyable thing, except with incredibly complicated software, right?
Right.
I mean, he destroyed that, but he didn't run that company like the steward of the next 100 years of Boeing engineering. He ran it to loot it and buy back stock.
To make a quick buck, right?
Yeah. And you know, Musk, in a lot of ways, Musk runs Tesla to make a quick buck, or he wouldn't stress the batteries so much, you know, and he wouldn't have this autopilot on the road today. He would wait And, you know, he would develop LIDAR. He would do it the right way that other people are and gradually bring it out. But he's like, oh, yeah, we'll deal with we'll move fast and break things. But, you know, unfortunately, he's breaking the bones of human beings, you know, and this is his attitude. And eventually, look, if the regulators don't handle it, who the hell knows with these guys, even though they are supposedly considering that. I mean, that guy put that incredible petition together on the sudden acceleration. You know, he basically compiled every single case and complaint, and they were all from Tesla owners. He didn't make that shit up. And of course, you know, Musk, the jerk that he is, you know, obviously he ghostwrote the Tesla, you know, press release and said, oh, it's from a short seller. Hey, guess what, pal? Here's all the cases, okay? Here they are, you know? And so anyway, there was a class action lawsuit about that filed yesterday. You know, we'll see where that goes. So far, Tesla has initially said all these lawsuits were bullshit, and then they've always settled them, right? And as far as I'm concerned, that means that they know something is fucked, because Musk doesn't settle a lawsuit if he thinks there's any iota that he's in the right, right? Look what he did with the cave diver. You know, look what he did with the SEC when he was fighting them. The only reason he stopped was the stock took a huge dive after he initially had rejected the agreement, you know? So if they're settling these things, there's a reason for it, you know?
Yeah, and the inaction by the NHTSA has been just wild.
Well, not just inaction, but the cover-up. I mean, Ed Niedermeyer wrote a great piece about it early last year. I think it was February or something. Like, literally, the NHTSA was complicit in Tesla's fake data of autopilot safety. I mean, it's just – it's crazy. That's a real story right there. Somebody should find out. It's one thing to be like bureaucratic inertia or whatever. It's something else to actively, you know, engage in a cover-up on behalf of a company. I mean, it's crazy. But look, this is the world we're in today. I mean, I follow the SEC on Twitter. And yeah, the SEC is fine on cracking down on small-scale scamsters. But look at the shit that Musk essentially got away with. And the SEC is on Twitter today saying, you know, we want to help small businesses raise capital. You know, that's not the fucking job of the SEC. Okay, they shouldn't make it, they shouldn't, you know, close the door on small business, but their job is to make sure that small businesses are, you know, following the rules and being honest and not bullshitting. They're not an investment bank, you know, so these are the priorities. You know, it's interesting. I had said to somebody the other day, Musk has been very, very, very lucky in that a lot of the crap that Tesla pulled during the Obama administration, they got away with because Obama had put all these greenies and stocked the government with greenies. And the greenies were like, oh, they're making electric cars. That's great. The end justifies the means. We'll let them pull all kinds of shit, right? And now Trump is in there and he's stocked the government with all these deregulators and anti-regulatory people. And so I think, you know, Musk's getting away with a lot of stuff because of that. He kind of lucked out in that regard, you know?
Yeah, and I think that still carries over, though, too. I mean, this administration has also kind of sat on its hands. I mean, the autopilot thing is egregious. If you ask me, every day I see a new article where a Tesla is involved in an accident, and, you know, occasionally somebody is killed, or a Tesla is plowing through the front of a, you know, cosmetic store.
Right, now we don't know.
Running a red light.
Right, now we don't know. Those aren't necessarily all autopilot.
Sure,
but it's not autopilot. It's sudden acceleration. And last weekend, I believe there were 4 accidents plus a spontaneous battery fire, you know, worldwide.
Yeah, that reignited, right?
Well, no, that was different. There was actually a spontaneous battery fire. There were 2. One was parked in a garage with 3 other cars. We don't know the cause yet. And one was in Europe somewhere where it just ignited. So, you know, there's all kinds of stuff with this car. And the percentage of incidents with this car relative to its peer group, which are, right, you know, less than 5-year-old luxury cars, not some fucking 30-year-old rickshaw, you know, in India with 500,000 miles on it. It's off the charts how bad it is for Tesla. And of course, Musk knows that. So he'll say, oh, well, there are whatever, you know, 1 billion cars in the world, and we're better than those 1 billion cars. Yeah, guess what, pal? Compare it to 5-year-old Audi, Mercedes, Cadillac, whatever. It's not even close how bad Tesla is and all this stuff. And by the way, on the sudden acceleration thing, you know, the best defense of the bulls and of Tesla itself is, oh, well, it's always driver error. The driver's hitting the wrong pedal. Well, here's the deal. Extremely well put together in that petition to the NHTSA. I forget the name of the guy who did it. Brian something.
I have no idea.
I don't follow him on Twitter, but I see his stuff. He did amazing work. Anyway, in there, he clearly showed that the sudden acceleration incidents with Teslas are off the charts relative to any other car. So even if it's due to driver error, hitting the wrong pedal or whatever, that is a design flaw in the car if they're making it too easy for a driver to hit the wrong pedal. That's a design flaw, right? So, you know, if the errors are happening that much, that's something wrong with the car and it needs to be fixed, right? And you know what? If their sensors are so great, they should be able to simply do a software update which says if you're facing a wall or a building or a person, the car won't accelerate, you know? But they haven't done that, and instead they deny it and blame the customers. But if it's happening that much, at that point, it's not the fault of the customers, it's the fault of your design.
The big problem is, though, if they're able to raise money and they're able to continue to keep this valuation where it is, they're going to be able to revamp all that stuff the proper way going forward.
Okay, so then they revamp it all and they find out that, you know, ultimate demand for their cars is, I don't know, with the Model Y, whatever, 500,000 a year,
right,
worldwide. And you know, they, and at 500,000 a year, you know, maybe they can make legitimately, not with their bullshit numbers, you know, 100 million a quarter. So, you know, maybe they can make 500 million a year on 500,000 cars a year. And that's it, because that's, you know, they're already running into negative comps on revenue. And the only reason they're keeping the volume up that they're doing is by price cutting or if there's a new incentive program. So, okay, so this is what I'm saying. So at the end of the day, you know, what's a car company worth, you know, that makes, you know, 500 million a year, right? Car companies are selling at 8x earnings, right? So that would make it worth $4 billion or whatever. It's got $11, $12 billion of debt. It's still worth less than the debt, you know? So this I've said from day one, before I even got involved with Musk being full of shit and a pathological liar, I just looked at this and said, look, these guys could be fucking huge and they're not worth what back then was, I don't know, $30 billion or whatever. And that's still the case, right? All this other stuff is kind of entertaining and unfortunately expensive, if you were short, noise. At the end of the day, there's a fixed demand for these cars. There's a fixed amount of possible profitability. And then there's a valuation, which is in most likelihood less than the net debt that they have. So that's, you know, that's the story. So, you know, this thing will converge to reality at some point. Obviously, I thought it would have happened a couple of years ago. But you know what? As this year unrolls and as Volkswagen starts flooding Europe with its electric cars in the second half of the year, and Volvo and all these other guys and Daimler and, you know, into 2021, I mean, eventually people will wake up and realize, whoa, you know, there's nothing special here except a lot of accidents and lawsuits.
Well, you could say the same thing about the macro economy. I mean, a lot of this is perception is reality, too. I mean, I think that the Fed is very much to blame for companies like Tesla having the valuations that they do. And I think we're reaching a point now where monetary policy and this dedication to low rates and propping up the stock market is enabling this kind of shit. And so then the question becomes, you know, what's the catalyst going to be for change there? I mean, if...
Right, so that's a great question.
Because what it's doing is it's creating fertile ground, Mark, for people to say, oh, it's a 20-year-out story. It's a 30-year-out story. It's a fucking robo-taxi story. You don't understand. It's not a car company. You know, the demand isn't as fixed as you think. It's, you know, well, it's okay, a lifestyle brand. There's brand equity, blah, 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 blah.
So, right. So I'll respond to the micro and the macro. As far as the micro, as far as Tesla goes, I think that when people see these other cars flooding showrooms starting in the second half of this year and even more extensively into 2021, I think they'll finally, and that will be coupled with, you know, flat to declining Tesla sales or maybe barely growing Tesla sales because the Model Y will like 80% cannibalize the Model 3. You know, then I think they'll wake up and, you know, maybe it's not overnight anymore, but, you know, there's just a, a convergence over a period of time to reality for this stock, right? The macro thing was very well stated on your show, I think, last week, which I was able to listen to actually because I was on a plane, by Bill Fleckenstein. And I agree with him 100%. And, you know, it's this. It's the Fed is – we have negative real interest rates. The Fed is printing so much money. There's, you know, forget all the repo stuff. They're printing $60 billion a month of QE to buy short-term treasuries. That, yeah, we don't know how big this bubble could get. You know, I mean, I've been saying this. I said it on Twitter. The Fed blew the 1999 bubble with 4% short-term rates, okay, when inflation was 2%. So it essentially had 2% real rates and no QE, no money printing, right? And we had that fucking 1999 bubble. Now we've got like one, call it 1.6% short-term rates with 2.3% core CPI. So we've got negative short-term rates of 50, 60, 70 basis points and $60 billion a month of QE. And if this market corrects 8 or 10%, the Fed will crank up the QE. Now, why is that? I'll tell you why. Because it used to be – the Fed used to believe that economic cycles were a normal and healthy part of capitalism, and you essentially needed them every once in a while to kind of clear out the dead wood and reinvigorate things, and that they would protect the dollar and not print money.
Also known as economics.
Well, also known – I don't know what you'd call it, but that was just the way – the correct way of thinking, right? Even that idiot Greenspan, the original bubble blower, at least to some extent, thought that. I mean, he never printed money. Then we got this fucking idiot jerk, Bernanke, comes along, and he says, oh, it's a tool in my toolbox. Nothing I hate. Yeah, the fucking jerk who probably never lifted a screwdriver talks about tools in his toolbox. But anyway, it's now a quote-unquote tool in his toolbox to print money, right, and eliminate the economic cycle. And of course, in capitalism, if you eliminate the cycle, you get a lot of dead wood, and you get like what Japan had, right? You get all these zombie companies and all this other bullshit. But if they're targeting stock prices, which they are, they've admitted it. I mean, what Fleckenstein said is 100% right. God knows how big this bubble gets, you know, before it bursts, and that's why, you know, in December, I took off, except for Tesla, I took off all of our equity shorts. We were short a bunch of bubble stocks, and actually most of them I took off at a profit. I mean, from where we had shorted them, you know, I just picked good points. But I don't want to be short anything that's not a crazy bubble and a fraud, in my opinion, which in my opinion Tesla checks those boxes, because who knows what they're going to do, right? I mean, we could get in a situation where people say, oh, well, you know, short-term, 10-year treasuries are 1.74, I'm looking at my screen, and short-term rates are, you know, whatever, like 1.6 or whatever, and I'm willing to, you know, buy the S&P 500 as long as earnings are stable, even if they're not going up. I'm willing to buy that at a, you know, at a 2.5% earnings yield or a 3% earnings yield. Well, that's a PE of 35 on the S&P, right? The gap PE now on the S&P, I think, is something like 25 or something trailing. So there could be a lot of room in this market. Who knows? I mean, I know what they did in 99 with much tighter money than we have today. That I know.
Yeah, and if we're living in reality, which we're not, as we just made the case, those warranties and the things that you're talking about 5, 6, 7, 8 years out, you know, that's an interesting point. You have all these cars now on the road, and at some point, the chicken's going to come home to roost in terms of warranties and in terms of service. And those are two big kind of, like you said, they're sacrificing those things now to just get these things out and not provisioning for the warranties correctly. But that is a bug that will come back to bite them at some point. You know, I still think the question is whether or not the stock will be able to outrun these problems, right? I mean,
well, again,
if the stock goes to 1,000, like you're talking about earlier, right? Just say it happened. Because 3 months ago, not you, not me, not anybody would have said the stock would have been at 600
all right,
now.
All right, hang on a second. All right. If the stock goes to 1,000, it means I'm wrong about the bubble being over. It means I'm wrong that it's recoupling to reality. And yesterday at you know, 594.50 was the high. I'm wrong. It means the bubble reignited and the disconnect from reality continued. And it's inarguably nothing but a disconnect from reality when you can buy a very profitable, and by the way, with sales growing, Volkswagen, you know, with 10 and a half million cars a year, and the same as Tesla with 400,000 cars a year. I mean, it's obviously, and in fact, I think Volkswagen is cheaper, I think, on an EV basis, but I'm not sure, but that's market cap. Anyway, so it's obviously a disconnect from reality, and I could be wrong, and you're right. It could continue to disconnect from reality, but let's just assume it's going to reconnect to reality, okay? You know, and ultimately they can sell 500,000 cars a year and make $1 billion a year, right? I mean, even, you know, even if you put a 30 multiple on $1 billion a year, $30 billion, you know, less 13 of debt, okay, whatever the debt is, call it 13, you know, leave 17 for the equity, and at that point there would be probably 200 million shares out, okay, even that's a double-digit number, right? That's $85 a share, and today the stock is $572.20. So could I be wrong about this ultimately being a zero? Yeah. Could I be wrong about having an ultimate price above the double digits? No, I don't think I can be wrong, because there are too many other electric cars coming out. They are mandated by the government, and they're all most of them are very good cars. You know,
people will say you're moving the goalposts, though, Mark.
Well, okay, so
because I'd seen your presentations that Tesla's a zero. We've all talked about it.
Well, I'm giving you a bull case here. Okay, the bull case would be, I mean, a reasonable bull case would be, you know, an $80 stock. You know, but I don't think that's going to happen. I mean, I think they'll never make money legitimately, and they will be worth less than the debt. But I'm saying, as someone who's short the stock, assuming this ever recouples with reality, I consider my downside, in other words, my risk, right, to be a mid to high double digit stock price. You know, and I don't think that's going to happen. And that's still down 80% from today.
Serious question. Stocks at $575. You're the CEO of the company. What would you do right now?
Wait a minute. Am I a CEO who's not a pathologically lying drug addict?
No. You're Mark Spiegel is CEO of Tesla. Tomorrow, effective 9 o'clock a.m., stocks at $575. Company has a valuation of $100 billion, essentially. Knowing everything that you know, what do you do? What's your first
I would immediately sell $15 billion of equity at $400. Versus the 572, and pay off all the debt of the company. That's what I would do.
Right. I mean, well, Musk
will never do that, because with that much stock out there, the stock, even without the debt, I probably wouldn't do that, because it would just so completely collapse the stock price. But I would definitely be selling some equity here. I wouldn't be taking on more debt. But I'm not running this as a stock promotion. So Musk, I'm pretty sure if he does anything, he's most likely, I think, to do another convert. You know, he'll set the conversion price at $750 or whatever if the stock is $570.
And a lot of what we're discussing and a lot of the things that you're saying makes it sound like there is a reasonable case for the stock, you know, coming lower, but, you know, maybe settling between 150 and 250 or something like that.
I don't think there's a reasonable case for the stock to settle between 150 and 250.
If you issued $15 billion in equity at $400, right, you could get that deal off, definitely. And you paid off all the debt.
By the way, I don't know that you could definitely get off, but let's say you could get off.
You could definitely get off. $400 a share?
So then how many shares do you have outstanding? Hang on. Hold on. Let's do the math. So $15 billion divided by 400. So you'd have 37.5 million shares on top of probably 183 million right now.
Right, which is like 20%.
Let's say you'd have 220 million shares outstanding,
right,
and no debt. Okay. Now, let's say you have let's say this company terms out at 500,000 cars a year. Okay. And let's say it terms out at legitimately making 200 million a quarter. You know, let's say without the warranty fraud and all the bullshit, we'll be generous. So let's say it makes 800 million a year, but that's it. So now it's just a car company. that's growing 3% a year like the rest of the car companies. And there's an 8x multiple on those companies, right? So if these guys are making $800 million a year, and you put an 8x, you put a 10x multiple on it, that's $8 billion. The debt is 11 or 12, so it's still worth less than the debt. The only way you can get even a double digit stock price here is, in my opinion, is if it has a crazy multiple relative to the rest of the industry. But the growth is not going to be there to justify a crazy multiple. I mean, again, you know, my guess is that this year maybe they sell 420,000 cars, you know, versus 370 or whatever, 360 something last year. I mean, that's not a lot of growth, especially when most of those cars are very low margin, you know, Model 3s or maybe Model Ys, you know.
So what's your like most insane bull case of the company being able to generate profit somewhere elsewhere aside from just car sales, right? It's obviously not being valued as a car company right now. All of your cases that you've given so far rely on the company kind of contracting to this 8x, industry standard traditional auto manufacturer multiple.
It almost doesn't matter. You could give them double the market multiple. You can give them 15x. You can give them 20x. You know, you still have a stock that's down whatever 90-95% from where it is now. You know, but anyway, go ahead. There's no other business here.
My question is,
the battery business. They buy the batteries from Panasonic in China. They're going to buy the batteries from, I forget, either LG or Samsung or maybe local Chinese companies. I mean, there's nothing proprietary there. I mean, it's proprietary, I guess, their software, which controls these batteries and stresses them to the max and whatever, you know, makes them not last so long. I mean, so there's no battery business. Solar is like, you know, he's pretending to be doing things with it. It's like a dying business. You can find stuff on Twitter. People can't get service for their SolarCity panels now. You know, these solar tiles that he said, we'll install them in 8 hours. The documented cases are it's taking like 3 weeks and a whole team of people to cut these tiles and put them on the roofs. I mean, the whole thing is like there's no other business here. It's just nonsense. They're way behind legitimate, leaders of autonomy. You know, it's like that's a whole nother fraud. You know, all year they had on the website coming later this year, automatic driving on city streets. That never fucking happened. You know, it's I think it's probably still up there now. So now it's now we can say, oh, well, now it's going to come the end of this year. Where's the FTC on this shit? But more than that, where are the morons who are paying him, you know, $6,000-$7,000 for quote unquote full self-driving and not getting it? They're getting this parlor trick of summon that, by the way, somebody told me they haven't looked at it yet, that Hyundai has the same thing. And BMW and Daimler have it also, but they haven't put it out there because they don't want some kid getting hit in a parking lot, you know, who's a foot and a half tall and a car doesn't see him, right? They're just because they're not reckless like Tesla. I mean, every feature out there that people think is some cool feature that makes Tesla worth all this money is actually a fucking future lawsuit liability, you know, en masse, you know?
There just seems to be compounding the warranty, responsibility, the legal issues. Those types of liabilities do seem to be compounding just kind of quietly in the background, you know, whether or not there's a day that comes where there's a reckoning with those things remains to be seen, but it's just going to be insanely difficult with the stock price where it is because it's. Do they have any debt outstanding now, Mark? That can convert? Do they have convertibles outstanding now?
They have convertibles in the money, but nobody's going to convert ahead of time because then you lose the optionality. I forget what the dates are. You know, next year, the year after.
What's the conversion price?
I don't even remember. Tell you the truth, I think there's some that converts in the high 300s, if I'm not mistaken.
Okay,
but I'm not sure. And I think there's another one that converts in the 500s. Yeah. I'd have to look. It's like, you know, here's the thing.
I mean, that takes care of that debt, though, right? At a discount.
But again, you could take care of the debt, you know, that debt tonight just by selling stock at a 5% discount or whatever. You know, that's why like people are like.
Yeah,
people
but if there's a conversion at $375 a share, you wouldn't sell stock at a 5% discount to take care of the debt. You'd allow them to convert.
Yeah, but nobody's going to convert until it comes due.
Correct.
And who knows what stock is going to be when it comes due. Maybe it's back down to 150 or 100 or whatever. So, You know, there's just so much stuff here that, look, here's the thing. I mean, there's so much evidence of nonsense. I mean, it was, you know, Montana skeptic Lawrence and another guy, Lewis Carruthers is his pen name on Twitter, wrote that thing with all kinds of examples about the warranty fraud where they call clear warranty repairs customer goodwill instead, and that way they avoid impacting, you know, gross margin. It helps them first justify the low reserve, right? There's all kinds of stuff there that an ambitious criminal prosecutor could take on and probably destroy this company. And somebody, I have to think somebody out there is probably, if not more than one, putting a case together, because there's always some ambitious guy, you know, who wants to make a big name for himself taking something down. So, you know, that's likely happening. But in the meantime, there will just be, I think, tremendous brand destruction here as the sudden acceleration story multiplies and as the autopilot deaths multiply and this kind of stuff. And, you know, at some point, you wreck the brand. I mean, when Audi had that sudden acceleration thing, it literally took 15 years for U.S. sales to recover to the point where they were before it got hit, you know? And so there's just so many landmines here. That's what keeps people short this thing, you know? So, look, there are plenty of expensive bubble stocks. I'm not short. But this thing just – and we've said this before, right? This thing just checks every box, you know? And that's why we keep coming back to it.
Yeah, and I hope that in a couple of months we can come back to it. Again, I appreciate you letting me play devil's advocate today and, you know, trying to give you the business a little bit. But I do genuinely, like I tweeted out, I do think the higher the stock price gets, the more difficult this is. The more breathing room and the more freedom that unfortunately...
But again, Chris, that's breathing room against bankruptcy, okay? But they've had that breathing room against bankruptcy really ever since the stock... you know, recrossed and went back over 200, right? Because you could, even at 200, you know, you could raise $2 billion without that much trouble. And that's, you know, a year and a half or 2 years or whatever of CapEx, cash burn, whatever. So bankruptcy has not been an issue, you know, ever since they were teetering near the edge of it, maybe when the stock was below 200 and things were looking really bad. So, but again, bankruptcy isn't the case. The case is it's just a fucking car company. Growth is slowed drastically.
Right.
There's all kinds of fraud here, and there's all kinds of dangerous stuff going on. So there's just potential for brand destruction. There's potential for some serious charges against Musk. I mean, there's all kinds of stuff. And you know, you'd have to think that there's enough employees who must know about this stuff. You'd have to think there's whistleblower stuff going on. You know, one day we'll wake up and, you know, they'll hit the guy up with charges, you know. So, you know, in the meantime, if it's recoupled with reality, people will start saying, well, wait a second, this should not be bigger than Volkswagen. This should not be bigger than BMW in terms of market cap. Should not be higher than Daimler, you know. You know, yeah, we think it's going to be great. Let's value it, I don't know, like Honda for a little while, and then we'll gradually find out, oh, this is no Honda either.
Right. Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see where it goes from here, undoubtedly. Will you come back in like 2-3 months and we'll follow up on how things go, or maybe even after earnings?
Yeah, oh, I'm happy to. By the way, to talk about earnings, I have no idea what earnings will be. I mean, on the back of my envelope, I could say, okay, 200 million gap. But who the fuck knows, because they play so many games, there's so much bullshit there, and their auditor apparently lets them get away with it. That, you know, I don't even like to guess when earnings are. By the way, before we sign off, I just saw another story here. Japan confirmed second case
of the
virus from China. I mean, you know, this thing is spreading. I mean, SARS back then completely crushed, like, the world economy, the Chinese stock market, the Chinese, you know. And so far, you know, the S&P closed up today. The world is oblivious to this. You know, Maybe it should. I don't know, but this is just the Fed printing so much money that there's no such thing as risk anymore. You know,
you're 100% right. Idiots. I mean, that's exactly what I just said to Fleckenstein, right? With the VIX where it is now, this is the Fed has taken the idea of risk out of the market. And
right. So, by the way, so to answer your original question, is what ends it? Well, what will end it is enough consumer inflation to really spook the Fed and make them stop printing. And then you'll get PE multiple compression and the whole fucking stock market will collapse. And what's that number? Well, the Fed looks at their made up bullshit number called PCE core, which right. I think is running at about 1.6. And now they're saying, well, we should be we should allow symmetrical inflation. So if it ran, you know, 10 years at 1.6 and our target is 2, then we should allow it to run 10 years at 2.4. So we average it. So they're coming up with all kinds of bullshit excuses, basically, to keep printing money forever. But if that number is starts running at 3 or 3.5%, then you're going to see them reel in the printing, and then the whole fucking thing is going to collapse. But right. I don't know when that's going to happen, because inflation has been – CPI core has been kind of steady, annualized at about 2.3. But and their PCE has been kind of steady at about 1.6, their PCE core, but it hasn't taken off yet, you know? And until it takes off, they could just keep blowing this bubble bigger and bigger and bigger. I'll say one last thing.
Yep.
Suggested by my friend Anton Wallman in an article he wrote for Seeking Alpha a few weeks ago, which I thought was a very sort of interesting theory, which is that as much as the Fed despises Donald Trump, they really despise him most as a person and a human being. They truly despise the philosophy of socialism, okay? And their biggest horror would be this economy and stock market collapse, and it winds up electing a Bernie Sanders.
Right.
And so the theory is that the Fed will do absolutely everything it can to keep this show going through Election Day. And what here's what would crash stocks besides, you know, a big uptick in inflation. If the market starts really believing that Sanders is going to be the next president, fucking stocks are going to crash, right. You know, at least until he gets in there and runs multi-trillion dollar deficits and appoints like the most dovish Fed head one could imagine to monetize all that debt for him. And then we just wind up with massive inflation and stock prices go up in nominal terms, and he fucking wrecks – he turns us into Venezuela basically, which he would try to do. But, you know, but that's later. So – but if people start thinking he's going to win, that will crash stocks. Or the other thing is, if Trump gets reelected, then the day after Election Day, the Fed might take its foot off the gas pedal and say, okay, we don't have the inflation we want, but we've blown this big asset bubble and Trump is safely here. We're not going to have a socialist for at least 4 years. And maybe that's when they stop printing. So the best time to short this market, actually, it's funny, in a mirror image of the best time to get long was the night, or really the day, I'm sorry, the day after Election Day, the day after Trump got elected. The best time to short this market might be the day after this coming Election Day,
right.
Either because Trump wins and the Fed says, okay, we're in the clear to stop blowing this bubble bigger, or, you know, Sanders wins and it just all goes to hell. So yeah. that's a good way to maybe try to time
it. A win-win if you're short, right?
Well, yeah, exactly right. A win-win if you're short. Like I would not want to be long the stock market. I mean, assuming it doesn't crash before then, I would not want to be long at these levels or higher levels the day after Election Day, almost no matter who wins. You know, unless maybe if Biden wins, it's innocuous and no big deal.
FUD. All FUD from you, Mark Spiegel. FUD, 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 FUDDY, FUD, FUD. Like my buddy said on the Now You Know podcast. Whatever, those guys just fucking doubled their money over the last, 6 months, as did all these other fantastic asset managers that are long Tesla. It's wonderful. I'd just like to, you know, thank the Fed for that. And hopefully this all ends in a fiery train wreck, because
you know what? I honestly, you know, someone said to me today, aren't you annoyed that all these bulls on Tesla are gloating and blah, blah, blah? Nah, I don't care. Listen, I know where these dopes will wind up eventually. And I don't really, it doesn't bother me. I don't care. I mean, you see these guys in every bubble market, and then the bubble bursts and they're buying their fucking pet stock all the way down to zero, right? Oh, it was 572.20 yesterday. Here at, you know, 525, it's a bargain.
Right,
and then it's a big bargain at 475 and a bigger. So I don't give a shit. No, what really annoys me is the absolute bullshit that this company's been able to pull without getting nailed by regulators, and the fact that their vehicles are doing this stuff out on the road and that Musk is getting away with it. That bothers me, because that's a regulatory breakdown.
Right.
You know.
And there's other, you know, there's innocent people involved too, that are the other people driving.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Innocent people. This is not some jerk who on his Twitter profile says, you know, my name is John Smith. I'm a clinical psychologist and a Tesla driver.
Right.
You know, I mean, there are douchebags who do that. Okay, great. I don't really, honestly, I don't care what happens to that douchebag. But I do care if that douchebag, you know, hits some, kills some lady in a hardware store, which is what happened yesterday in I think in Germany, somewhere in Europe, or, you know, because it goes through the window, or they take out someone on a bicycle, you know, or they think their autopilot works and they turn their 5,000 car into a battering ram, which goes sideways through a traffic light into a Honda and kills two innocent people. I mean, that kind of shit, that bothers me, and it's a complete regulatory breakdown by the NHTSA that's been going on here.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. I think that's a good note to end on. Spiegel, thanks for joining me, brother. And what's your Twitter handle again, in case people want to follow you and they don't already?
It's my name. It's at Mark B. Spiegel, MarkBSpiegel.
All right, Spiegel, we'll have you back on again soon, brother. Next time there's some news, hopefully the worst is over for the shorts. But but who knows, man? With the way things are going,
I don't know either. I got stops. So if I'm wrong, I'm wrong. I'll stop myself out. Thank you, man. Good talking to you.
All right, brother. We'll talk soon.
Take care. Bye-bye.
That was the one, the only Mr. Mark Spiegel of Stanfield Capital. Glad he could join me and glad I could finally appease all those people that were nudging me to have him on, all the people that wanted to gloat, all the longs. There he was. He said he got it wrong. I even gave him the business a little bit on this podcast, which I thought was needed to be done, which is good. And I appreciate Mark's candor and being able to speak with me. All right now, folks, I am out of here. I got a big, nice interview lined up for next week. I can't wait to do. Somebody I'm super stoked to talk to. But for right now, I'm the fuck out. Peace!